Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
Hello and welcome to the Modern Adventurer podcast, where adventurers and explorers tell their stories. Coming up.
When we got to the top, we found this little concrete pillar, about this big, you know, one bag of concrete. And a Dutch team had been there in 1936, it was 1930s. And they'd all written their names under there and smashed a beer bottle. And you just, you know, completely bonkers, because we didn't even know this was up there, and how these guys had done it. We think they must have been part of some sort of survey team. You know, the last people standing on that mountain. It was almost more interesting than, I think, actually was more interesting than being on an unclimbed mountain. I'm not a big unclimbed mountain guy. So to suddenly go up there and just think, you know, the last people standing here was almost 100 years ago.
I'm John Horsfall. I'm an adventurer, and here each week I will be talking to adventurers and explorers from around the world who have made remarkable and daring journeys in recent years. From Everest climbers to polar explorers, world record holders, and many more. I hope this podcast sparks ideas and inspires you to explore and go on your own grand adventure. But before we start, if you've enjoyed the podcast, sign up to the monthly newsletter, which is in the description below, where I show you behind the scenes, I do giveaways, and offering you the chance of an adventure. My next guest is Ollie Broadhead, an explorer and adventure photographer. Having spent his childhood following his curiosity, his expeditions now include a first attempt of a remote Sumatran mountain while walking across India, as well as cycling to the Arctic Circle. On today's podcast, Ollie is talking in detail about the struggles he had in India, as well as the conflicts that are happening at the moment out in Sumatra. So let's get on with the podcast. Ollie, welcome to the show.
Cheers.
Hi. Well, Ollie, I mean, it's great to have you on, and it's unbelievable some of the trips you've done. And I was really fascinated to sort of get down to sort of details about how you sort of started and some of your trips, especially in India. We had Iris, who you know very well, on quite a few weeks back, and she was talking about the story of Sumatra, which I'm sure you have other stories as well to tell. But before we jump into that, let's find out a bit more about you and how you got into all these sort of adventures.
I grew up in rural Cornwall, so it's always been, you know, nature on my doorstep. I've been extremely lucky with that, and the sea as well, actually. So I've always, really, as far back as I can remember, I've been certainly freediving and sea kayaking, and then other things like, you know, climbing and all that came later. And I think, you know, initially, like I think a huge number of people in the UK, I wanted to be David Attenborough when I was about, you know, six. So I was always off foraging for bugs, foraging for frogs, all that sort of stuff. But I think one of the things that definitely I would say at that age you could possibly already notice, I was really obsessed with sort of the longer adventure, the more immersive sort of thing. So, you know, what I mean by that is I would much rather I'd much rather stay out overnight, even when I was that old. I remember when I was like about 8 years old. I think it was my eighth birthday actually, and like my birthday wish was that I could go camping by myself, because I'd read somewhere that like the legal age of being able to camp alone was like 14, and I remember my dad just being like, you know, well, go on then. Just like that night out in the, wood. And I think it's been the same with almost everything. With like, I haven't been content to, you know, to do a sport like to go kayaking or to go, you know, even to like go and free dive with seals or something. I would so much rather spend, you know, a day on an island or camp overnight or, you know, stay out longer. And that was something I was always doing. I was always trying to do like multi-day little treks down streams, even when I was about, you know, 11 or 12, I think. That's been really consistent.
I think we all want to be David Attenborough.
It's sad as you just grow up, you just realize it's a bit unrealistic, but you all start aiming high, don't you? And then and then that just sort of evolved. I think the first thing I did was when I was, well, I mean, I traveled quite a bit. I'd always traveled. Luckily, again, my parents had worked abroad, and we traveled a bit with them. I've traveled quite a lot with them actually growing up. So it was never like that being an issue. It was, but as a, yeah, first year at university was like my first proper adventure, I guess, which was I basically had no money as first year student. You don't. And I was just trying to think of something I could do for effectively no money and with no planning, because I was sort of coming up with this idea whilst my exams were coming up. And I decided to, I had a mate in Norway, a mate who lived in Oslo. He said he'd lend me a bike. I decided I'd cycle to the Arctic Circle because you just have to aim north. It's very simple navigation. You take a compass, you don't need a map. And that was about it. I mean, as bad as it is for the environment, I do think about that a lot more. You know, you could get a flight to Oslo for, I don't know, like 20 quid or something. So even in Norway, and then obviously Norway is a very expensive country. So I had this slightly bonkers diet, because I think I budgeted about £5 a day for a month cycling. And what I could get for that in Norway was two bananas, half a loaf of bread and half a bar of chocolate a day. So I lost about 10 or 12 kilograms over that month-long period. And as many muscles as I could find. Luckily, as I stuck to the coast, there's this gorgeous coast road that goes all the way up from Bergen in the south, which is where all the fjords and mountains are, and then it goes all the way up to the Arctic. And you can sort of follow it along through all these sort of coastal pine forests. And it's a small road. It's nice, like single lane road. And so, yeah, as many shellfish as I could forage, and I had like this one tube of tomato paste I'd got from Lidl before I left. So I was sort of squirting that onto, you know, very sparingly. I think I made it last about 3 weeks. And yeah, I mean, I managed it. So that was a huge confidence boost. Not without some wobbles along the way, because it was June. I think I actually cycled through the summer solstice. But being Norway, it rained all but 2 days. And I mean, freezing rain. And, you know, -5 degrees at night. So it was properly grim. And I had a few wobbles. It was certainly the longest I'd been. It's the thing you don't think about. Obviously, I was solo for that. And I sort of suddenly realised after like a week of sort of basically not speaking to anyone that this was definitely by far the longest I'd ever gone without sort of communicating with a human, you know, because I was, you know, occasionally passing. It's quite rural. So you're maybe passing, lots of people live in cities in Norway. So actually when you get into the countryside, there's sort of people's summer houses potentially, you know, little fishing lodges and stuff, but they're quite often deserted. So I did start to go a bit mad. I remember at one point sort of really quite seriously believing I was being chased by trolls. Sort of like I could sort of feel shadows moving outside my tent, and I was being really quite, you know, panicky when I was having my back to anything, like collecting water, when you've got to like do that proper, I guess it's a proper animal instinct, isn't it? It's, you know, your head's bent, you're looking at the stream. It's the perfect time when something gets you from behind if you're a little gazelle or something. So yeah, I mean, I had a few little wobbles, but I mean, I made it, and it was actually amazing. It was possibly still one of the best days of my life, was for all the right reasons, was arriving in the Arctic, because we had like absolute howling wind and rain and gnarliness coming on shore right on the coast. Like the road was 3 meters from the sea, so you had waves splashing up. I was absolutely drenched, freezing. And then as soon as I got actually to the Arctic, at about 10 that evening, sky just opened, completely clear, a beautiful sunset, and obviously it's the midnight sun. And I had the midnight sun in the Arctic for like the 3 days I was there. Climbed up a few mountains. It was absolutely, and thus I was camped just on the edge of this fjord that just dropped, completely crystal clear water. So going down like 15 or so meters, you could see straight down, and then this ledge, and then this drop into the absolute abyss. And you have these codfish coming up from the depths and sort of going along this ledge. And this ledge was just littered with starfish and sea urchins, but huge. They've got starfish the size of car tires there. These amazing colors like purple and orange, and sort of plunging into that and then getting out and seriously regretting it because it was so bloody cold. But that sort of enforced it was probably the right decision, and I did hugely enjoy it, which is obviously sort of why I started planning more ambitious things after that. But that was definitely the thing that got me started, I think.
Were you much of a cyclist before you did that?
Oh God, no. Yeah, I should have led with that. So I live in hilly, laney Cornwall, and cycling's a bit sketchy around here at the best of times. We've got the hedges outside my house are about the height of a double-decker bus, so it's very much a blind prayer if you're taking a corner on a bike. So I've pretty much never cycled. You know, all my mates can attest to that I'm actually a laughing stock on a bike. And yeah, and I had no real fitness for cycling certainly when I set off. So I just sort of made it work. The first day I was like, okay, I'll get 100k done, and I did about 110k, and then the next day I couldn't walk pretty much. I was just hobbling along, did about 10k. It was really not. I just remember thinking, bloody hell, if I was gonna learn to cycle across a country, I should have chosen the Netherlands. You know, I should have chosen a flat country. First few weeks were just mountains. Anyway, yeah, I mean, I survived it, so obviously learned a bit. Forgot it all immediately after. Still can't cycle.
I think it was day three when I was doing Across America, and day three was the killer. And you'd sort of walk into supermarkets and your legs would feel like jelly, like you were about to keel over. Even though like your mind was very normal and your body was, your legs were just like, would just give way. And then it sort of took about, a week or two before it sort of caught up with it, because you're doing it every day, I imagine.
A couple of weeks will get you into anything, I think. It is amazing what your body can adapt to fairly quickly, as long as you don't get too injured. Yeah. No, I finished fairly injury-free.
I mean, I'm intrigued to imagine what these trolls that were chasing you were like.
Quite bear-like. Bears covered in moss, I think. Definitely. I mean, there was at one point where I was setting up my tent and a tree collapsed behind me, or a big branch came off a tree, and I pretty much jumped out of my skin. I was so certain it was this. I don't know if you've seen the film Troll Hunter, but it's a brilliant Norwegian film, and I think I'd watched that a bit too recently. And it's the whole theme is that trolls are real and the Norwegian government's been covering them up, and they occasionally come out and eat people. Sort of Blair Witch Project style. It's very funny.
Like watching Hostel before you go backpacking.
Yes, yeah. There's certain things you just shouldn't do. And yeah. why mess with your mind? Why mess with it? Yeah.
Always makes for a more exciting trip. So after that, you were absolutely hooked. And I suppose you went back to uni and you were pretty much planning the next one.
Yes, I was. I was. I think what I found was, I mean, I know it sounds weird. I really, really like people. I'm more interested in people. I know it sounds silly, like more interested in people than nature, but there's that crossover. Like Norway, you are staring at a mountain in the distance for a whole day, and it's the same mountain. What I mean is it's a big landscape. It's big, wide open. It's been a big, not on a human scale at all. And you're obviously spending a lot of time just thinking on a bike. 14 kilometers uphill. It's a lot of time to think. And so I was really interested to go somewhere where there were more people. And I was really interested. As a Werner Herzog, the Austrian filmmaker, there's a quote by him I quite like, which is, tourism is sin, traveling on foot is virtue. And what he sort of means by that, or what I've taken to mean by that, is quite often tourism can be like voyeuristic. And it, what I mean is you are not actually engaged. You're just looking at, it's like you go to a zoo. There's no vulnerability on your part. You're not actually immersed in that situation. Whereas if you do something like cycle or walk through a landscape, anyone can stop you, ask what you're doing, ask where you're going, have a conversation with you. It's not like you're not in any way separate. And the most extreme form of that is obviously walking. So I was really interested in walking, because at a walking pace, you will have to engage with people and you are forced to slow down. You won't miss stuff in the same way. It's, you could go out and look at a hedgerow and you could cycle down that lane and see nothing, or you could walk and be observant and see 1,000 things. So I was really interested to do a long walk. And India was a country I've been to with my parents before, and I know I absolutely loved, and I knew it was absolute madness. It's a bonkers and it's quite a wonderful country. And so I was looking for something that I could do, and I had the time constraint. All my time constraints at the time were, what could I do in a summer holiday from uni? So 3 months. So how far could I walk in 3 months? And I thought I could probably walk the length of the Kaveri. And the Kaveri is one of the 7 holy rivers in India. It's the southernmost of the great sacred rivers of India. And what's cool about it is it cuts basically the whole, it's a bit weird, it cuts the whole way across the country. It starts on the west coast, about 20 kilometers, very close to the west coast, maybe 40. And instead of just logically flowing to the west coast, it goes, oh no, I'm going the other way. And it flows all the way, hundreds and hundreds of kilometers, all the way across the east coast. So if you start on the east coast, you can follow it all the way up to its source, and you can basically do the whole country following a river. And I think you can see a theme here, which is I really don't like navigating, or at the time I certainly didn't. So it was very simple, again, take a compass, start and go west, and you'll get where you need to go eventually. So it was the same sort of thing in terms of the simple navigation, and the times just worked. So that became my next project.
And so what was it, so sort of planning that project, what was the route?
Okay, so in terms of the states, so it's the most southern states. So you've got on the east coast, I'm going to try and get this right, on the east coast you've got Tamil Nadu, middle you've got Karnataka, and then you end in Kerala. The slightly bonkers thing is about Indian states, you can't think UK counties, think much more American states. I mean, I think Tamil Nadu alone has a population higher than the whole of the UK's. It's like 75 million people. So they're vast, and they have their own languages as well. So each of those, Tamil Nadu, they speak Tamil, Karnataka, they speak Kannada. I'm going to be really dim, and I've completely forgotten what they speak in Kerala. So you're going through three, almost like three countries in terms of the language, but also in terms of the culture, the history. Historically, they would have been independent. So it's an amazing journey in terms of the diversity of it, and also in terms of the geography. So Tamil Nadu, when we were there, was at the end of a horrendous drought, a 4-year drought. And that drought ended just after we finished, but not in a good way. They had some like the worst flooding in 100 years. And it was bonkers, actually. We stayed with some students after we had finished this walk, and their whole house was flooded out, rats and snakes in the kitchen, all this kind of stuff, really bad, just after we left. But when we started, it was boiling hot. I mean, like over 40 degrees in the day. Everything was effectively a desert. You know, walking through crop fields that were just dust, proper grim dust bowl, for weeks and weeks, not a single cloud in the sky. And it was very stupid. I mean, things to be aware of when you go to our country that you just never think of in the UK are heat stroke. And I got heat sick once, and then heat stroke, proper heat stroke, where I was really bad. I was with a guy, and there's an interesting story actually to how I, well, not an interesting story, but there's a story to how I ended up going with someone. I was going to do it solo. And then about a month before I was going to actually set off, I freaked out and I thought, this is a bloody long way to go solo. This isn't quite Norway. Maybe I should go with someone. And I sort of advertised on Facebook saying, does anyone want to go walk across India? It'll cost about this much. Again, it was insanely cheap. I think the whole thing cost under 700 quid or something. And I got loads of responses, but it was mainly from people way older and more experienced than myself. So, and at the time I didn't really want to hand over you know, who's in charge, because it was my thing that I wanted to do, and I didn't want to go with someone who'd be saying we're going here, we're going there. And there was a guy in the year below at uni who I'd never met, also studying biology, who said, yeah, I'd go. And we met once, I think, before we actually met at the airport. So it was a bit bonkers. And he was putting a lot more trust in me than I was putting in him, because I'd been to India before and he'd never left. Then he might not have left the UK, and he'd certainly never traveled alone. And at this point, I had, even aside from the fact I'd only done one sort of expedition thing before, I'd traveled quite a lot within Europe by myself and actually kind of all over the world a little bit. So I was much more experienced in that sense than him. So I'm very brave on his part, sort of throw his lot in. It was a bit bonkers. Anyway, he ended up pretty much saving my life in week two or three, because we ran out of water in the middle of the day. I basically fainted and was waking up being sick, completely, effectively feeling very drunk, you know, completely had lost the ability to help myself as I was at that sort of stage of heat sickness. And he walked several kilometres on, got to the next village, and then managed to get water, come back to me, basically pour a load of water on me. He dragged me into the shade, keep that going till it got dark, and then we walked together to the next village. And I basically was just gone for like 2 days, completely collapsed. So that was lucky. I had someone with me, and I have learned, and it's something I always tell people when they're going to, if people are asking for advice about anything that's in a hot country, it's just so easy to happen. It sneaks up on you. It really does. The same with hypothermia. It's those things that you're in a temperate environment like the UK, you're just not prepared for, and the things you don't even think about, those are the really dangerous things. It's, you factor in, oh, you know, there's going to be snake bites or something potentially, so we'll take X, or what happens if X, we'll take a radio, but what happens if? It's the stuff you don't think about that's really dangerous, and that was something I'd never considered even an issue before I set out, which is very stupid of me.
No, that's quite the sort of story. I think when you pick a partner, we had Ian Finch on last week, and he was saying that you've got to have the right goals when you go on a sort of expedition like that. You both have to have goals, either whether it's, and you've got to know what each other wants to achieve out of it. Otherwise, you could be staring down very different paths. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would. I would absolutely. And I think it worked. I can't remember, I was reading this, but if you absolutely nail your roles, and then you've got to, I also think, be very careful of not stepping across that boundary. There's almost like an artificial politeness that comes into play on expeditions, more so than in real life, wherein you know, if someone's the photographer and someone's X, the writer perhaps, and the writer says, oh, there's a cool thing over there, I'll just grab his camera, he's not using it, I'll take a photo. And this is not something that's ever happened to me, but it's something you start to notice the edges of. And when you start stepping into other people's prescribed areas, it just creates stress. So you've got to be really careful that not only do you have, this is what you do, this is what I do, you know, you navigate, and I don't question your navigation because I'm not the navigator. And if there's a mistake, it's on you. So there's a flip side to that, you know. And of course, same with any role. But you do really have to lay down responsibility, because that's one of the really interesting things about expeditions. They do teach responsibility, you know, especially a solo expedition, everything is on you, but you've got to maintain those responsibilities, that level of responsibility, into other expeditions. You don't give someone like a role for the sake of giving them a role that you're not really going to trust them with. You've got to say, no, this is what you're doing. If you're the team leader, or you're dividing it up before, because you don't necessarily need to have a team leader, but you're really strict on, this is your role, this is my role. If they ask, if they say, oh, I'm busy photographing this, quickly take a video of that, that's fine. But it's when it's, don't, you've got to be really careful in proportioning that. I don't know if I quite phrased that right. But stuff that's worked really well is my partner, Iris. You know, she's a much more serious scientist than I am. And so she would always be, you know, absolute science lead. And I would always be photography and pretty much everything else. So, you know, in terms of camping, all that kind of setup, food, that sort of stuff, the logistical, and let's say also the, probably the media side, writing and photography. So, of course, I'm very happy for her to help on any of that, and she's very happy for me to help. But like, you've got those very clear delineations, and it makes it much easier. But I think the other thing is, in terms of picking, because I've been asked before, like, do I prefer like solo versus team stuff? I say the problem with solo is you can really push yourself at home or in familiar terrain. Let's say if you're an experienced mountaineer, you can really push yourself solo, or experienced kayak or whatever. But when you're in a new environment, it doesn't matter how good you are, you know, stuff goes wrong if you don't know the terrain. And so it's the biggest safety aspect you can have is a partner, you know, way better than a radio or tracking beacon or the best med kit in the world is having a partner. So it allows you to push yourself. So I'm really in favor of at least having one other person, preferably two, you know, on a team. I'm much for teams. And I also think if you find the right person, you get someone who pushes you into the areas you're uncomfortable, but they're comfortable, and you push them in the same way. So perhaps, you know, okay, the most silly version of that would be someone's a bit scared of heights and someone's a bit scared of the dark, you know, so someone's saying, okay, we're going to walk through the night, and someone's saying, oh, and we're going to go, you know, we're going to climb this bit or whatever. And that was a, you know, that's a completely flippant, made up example. But I think you get what I mean in that, you know, if someone's saying, no, we're going to really push to get this particular biological objective, this particular, you know, absolutely making sure you nail the, let's say, the data collection, and someone is absolutely making sure you nail the safety and the, you know, the logistical side of it. And, you know, you're both absolutely on it and pushing it further than it would have gone if you had been individual. So it's really, really important, that sort of complementariness. You don't necessarily want to pick someone who's exactly the same as you.
No, I agree. I've done a few trips with other people, and as I said, we've sort of covered, it's so important to have those roles. And on the trips, luckily, you know, they're amazing at logistics. Usually when I go on my own, I'm just free will. It's just, you know, no map, just cycle and see where it takes you, or walk or run, and, you know, just look on Google and go, okay, down there. But when it's, you know, when it involves visas and logistical know-how of this, you know, that's them, and they were pro, and it sort of seemed to work really, really well. And of course, you have that, I don't know, sometimes you have those little frictions here and there, but because you have your certain roles, as you said, you can sort of manage it.
Yeah.
So sort of talking about sort of logistical nightmares, you had quite a tricky time in Sumatra, is that right?
Yeah, Sumatra's interesting. It's got, by the way, heads up, you know, Indonesia, as of 2019, has made it a hell of a lot harder to do anything there. They brought in very strict rules around visas, and if you're breaching, you know, if they think you're nudging across from being, let's say, a tourist to being a journalist, then you can end up with, like, genuinely years in prison, and they're not messing around with it. Like, the Indonesian government's pretty hardcore. It's getting it's almost regressing now, but hardcore is a bit of an understatement. And you can really fall afoul of it. And BBC journalists and Nat Geo people have fallen, you know, you don't have the permit for this specific area, you're going to prison. I think there are still BBC linked journalists in prison in Indonesia. So it's really something to be careful of, and it's become a lot more potentially dangerous since we were there. When we were there, it wasn't even a particularly undangerous time. so we were looking at trying to do a biodiversity survey in Sumatra, and we got in contact with a friend of a friend of a friend, someone who'd got a Nat Geo grant to go and cover some of the restoration work after the 2004 tsunami. So they knew a lot of people at the university out in Aceh, which is effectively, think of it in terms of both independence, past history, all that, how as sort of the Scotland of Sumatra, and Sumatra is one of the Indonesian islands. And actually, just for a bit of quick context, Sumatra and all of the Indonesian islands were not historically united. The Dutch owned them, and when the Dutch left in the 60s, I think it was maybe 1960 actually, Java effectively seized control. And that doesn't sit well with a lot of the outlying islands, particularly the ones like Sumatra, which were historically very rich and independent and, you know, potentially different religions and all this kind of stuff. So it's almost can be seen as an empire owned by Java up to a point. And it's that's a bit of a wrong statement. It depends kind of which island you're on. But Sumatra's got a bit of an independence streak, and Aceh in particular had been fighting a sort of ongoing civil war for about 30 years, which had ended basically with and because of the tsunami. The 2004 tsunami hit closest point of land was Aceh, and it absolutely devastated the coast there. And so I think 100,000 people almost died in Aceh alone. So they had to accept relief efforts, which meant they had to effectively end the civil war. So good thing or a bad thing, depending on who you ask. So it was an interesting time to go there. Sort of terrorism had been fairly ongoing up until sort of late 2010 sort of time. So we were going 2016, so sort of been quiet for about 5 or 6 years. But so we eventually found someone, we got good contacts. We got contacts with university professors out in Aceh. And there was some fascinating stuff. So Aceh's amazing rainforest, and it's also some of the fastest deforested in the world. You can look at a map of Sumatra sort of for the last 20 years. I literally mean from 2000 to 2020. And it's like someone's got on a razor and just rubbed out the rainforest going up the country. A country the size of the UK, you know, just going from 90% forest to about 10% forest. So it's really quite upsetting, especially as they have some of the most amazing megafauna. It's the only country in the world where you've got a great ape, you've got the orangutan, you've got elephants, you've got rhinoceroses, you've got tigers, you know, and you've got gibbons as well. So you've got all these amazing species living, you know, in the same ecosystem. And so we eventually got hold of this guy, and he was suggesting we go to this valley that's 40 kilometers long in the middle of very inaccessible forest, cordoned off on each side by, like, I think 4,000 meter mountains, so 3,000 meter mountains. So very inaccessible to get in, and then this 40 kilometer long valley. And I was actually saying earlier that we were very naive initially in the timings of how long this would take. Cause I was, you know, last thing I'd done was walking India when you could quite easily do 40 kilometers in a day. So I was thinking, you know, what's this, 2 days walk? And so you need more like a month. And actually it turned out that when we did go to actually a separate place in Aceh, our record was basically walking dawn till well into the night. So I don't know what, 14, 15 hours on our feet and covering about 2.5 kilometers as the crow flies, because, you know, it's mountain forest. So it's like this steep part, you're practically climbing. You're climbing through something that's pretty, you know, let's say a bramble hedge is probably the closest thing you could get in the UK. It's stuff called rattan. It's what you make that sort of quaint furniture out of. But in the wild, it's covered in spikes about this long. It just weaves through itself, and it loves mud. So if there's rattan thicket, there tends to be a lot of mud as well. So mud and spikes and steep slopes are good fun. And anyway, so we were like, okay, we'll try and do this. And we tried to get permits. We emailed absolutely everyone, you know, every forest department and wildlife, you know, station there was to try and get into this place. And eventually we had to fly out without permits. And we ended up, we were in contact with a few people. So we were going to meet people, weren't going completely blind. And after about 5-6 days, when we landed, we met a couple of guys we've been put in touch with who are very cool. They're a couple of Sumatra mountaineers called Saeed and Roy, and together they're trying to make 100 first ascents in Sumatra, which I think gives you an idea of the number of first ascents there are to be made in Sumatra. And they're serious mountains. They're 3,000 plus meter mountains. And I think they made over 14 or 15 first ascents between them and already. And they were really keen to help us. And so they were obviously Indonesian, they were Achenese actually, and they were really helpful in trying to get permits, and, you know, going to the police and all this kind of stuff. And eventually we just got completely shut down. It was just red tape after red tape. You know, we've been told you had to take a police officer with you, and you had to take X number of government officials with you, and all this. And it was, you know, with all of the will in the world, you don't want to take people who don't want to be there and don't like you into a dangerous environment on a potentially dangerous expedition. So we ended up saying absolutely not. And we sort of found out later that potentially that forest had been logged, that valley had been logged, which is a shame, because the reason we were really interested in going there, when I say a shame, I mean a tragedy, because the reason we'd been interested in going there, and the reason this guy had suggested, he was an orangutan expert. And in 2017, the same professor was actually instrumental in identifying a new popular new species of orangutan. So Sumatra previously was thought to be home to the Sumatran orangutan, which is a critically endangered species, and it turned out that a population of about 100 of those weren't Sumatran orangutans at all. They were a different species that had been isolated, I think, after the last ice age, and were a completely different species. And they were the newest, they are the newest ape species, and also the most endangered ape species today. Great ape. And they were potentially in that valley, and that valley's potentially been completely logged. So we had to fairly quickly, you know, within days, come up with a new objective. And luckily, because we linked up with these two mountaineers, Roy and Saeed, they had an objective in mind, which was this unclimbed mountain, Mount Kurok, 3,050 meters up in the middle of Aceh. But what's so interesting about that is it's actually in the middle of some vast area of intact forest, you know, unimaginable when you grow up in the UK, hundreds of square kilometers. And that's completely intact, and it's intact because it's in mountains. So the forest starts at about 1,600 meters, but the forest proper intact forest is at about 2,000 meters plus. But luckily it's sort of not a plateau, but it's mountains from 2,000 meters to 3,000 meters sort of just undulating across with covered in forest. And the reason it's been protected is just impossible to get logging machinery, and it would be useless for growing palm oil, all that sort of stuff. So we decided to go there with the aim that we couldn't find any research in this area previously. And that's another amazing thing about Sumatra. It's very underfunded for conservation. So there are large, and it's vast. So you've got not much money, vast areas, and the funding therefore tends to go to small points, you know, to pockets known to be biodiverse, to reserves that already exist. So there's a lot of area that is almost certainly bursting with life, but there's just not the money spare to go and conduct research in those places. So we were very lucky to be the first people going to conduct a biodiversity survey of any sort within this forest. And, you know, Mount Kurok being unclimbed also meant that it was not researched either. And that was that. And we eventually got permits to go there, and it was much easier to get permits there because it's not protected, which at the same point was quite worrying because we were really unsure what we were going to find. And actually on the first day hiking out, the first people we met were hunters who'd been shooting in the forest and had caught some beautiful birds, who I'm not criticizing at all, because I think that's very important to draw lines between people who are hunters and people who are poachers. And they were definitely hunters, you know, just coming from the village, just, you know, a relationship with the forest rather than extractive or destruction of the forest. And like I say, that was brutal hiking. Just to get to Mount Kurok was like 2 weeks of some of the worst, well, not the worst, the most brutal hiking I've ever done. And I think the thing you don't think about when you think of a beautiful forest is you don't see the forest. You see the trees, and you see several meters in front of you of moss and rotting tree trunk and all this kind of stuff that you don't quite picture. And it was pretty much after the first week, I think we got onto a ridge where we could see across the forest. I took some photos there, which are the photos I always use for any speech, where you've got rolling forest going to the distance, but it wasn't like that at all. I mean, most of the time you're sort of almost crawling on hands and knees. And then of course, when we got to Kurok and tried to climb Kurok, we had some beautiful views as well. But the maps we had were awful, like properly, you know, they were taken from plane mapping. So completely wrong scale for walking on foot. And we got to the base of Kurok at about 2,500 meters, expecting a ridgeline that would be followable. And actually what we had is a series of cliffs, about 90 meter cliffs, another ledge, cliff, ledge. And when I say cliff, I mean like choss and moss and roots coming out, you know, falling off in your hands. No way you could attempt it without some fairly serious planning and serious care. And there's not like there's any rescue option there. So it was something we backed off with. But we actually climbed Mount Lombu, which is in the same massif. It's just next door, almost the same height. And we were the second team up. When we got to the top, we found this little concrete pillar, about this big, you know, one bag of concrete. And a Dutch team had been there in 19, off the top of my head, I might be wrong, 1936, it was 1930s. And they'd all written their names under there and smashed a beer bottle. And you were just, you know, completely bonkers, because we didn't even know this was up there. And how these guys had done it. We think they must have been part of some sort of survey team. You know, the last people standing on that mountain. It was almost more interesting than, I think, actually was more interesting than being on an unclimbed mountain. I'm not a big unclimbed mountain guy. So to suddenly go up there and just think, you know, the last people standing here, it was almost 100 years ago, and they were in an era completely, you know, in colonial Indonesia, owned by the Dutch, forced, you know, I don't think they particularly enjoyed hiking all the way out here. The Dutch invasion was fought back against brutally. You know, the Acehnese gave pretty good. I think the famous story is the first day the Dutch arrived in Aceh, I think the commander of the entire invasion force was shot by an Acehnese sniper. So it was not a, you know, it was a proper war zone. It was not just a walk in and stick a flag kind of image of colonialism, because the Acehnese were being backed by the British. So they had guns. And so, yeah, I mean, it was a proper, you know, free fall back in time moment. It was amazing. And when you looked out, we could see, you know, to the horizon, unbroken forest, which I hope is something I will see again. It's the only time in my life I've ever seen it. Yeah, just like looking at a sea of forest and just hearing gibbons about 1,000 meters below calling up the side of this forested mountain. It was like, you know, absolutely awe-inspiring. And from there, we walked to the coast. And the whole way we were doing a biodiversity survey, which actually was got some amazing results. It was an incredibly biodiverse area. We found critically endangered Sumatran orangutans, very endangered species of gibbon called a siamang. It's the biggest gibbon. It's a huge, black, beautiful animal. And as well as some small cat species as well. And a load of birds, about 80-something bird species. And for context, we were actually in that area, our focus survey area, for about 3 days. So, you know, 80-plus bird species in 3 days isn't bad going. So it was absolutely mind-blowing.
Wow, what an absolute adventure, really. Just had everything to it.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's the thing I've been always trying to do and still trying to do, which is, you know, you gain experience slowly. I couldn't have jumped in with that. So it was, you know, each expedition leads to the next one and the skills come across. You can't say from day one, I'm going to do an ambitious physical expedition with a scientific objective, because the scientific objective adds so much to the, you know, stopping every hour, taking off your pack, conducting a survey. I know it sounds good to take off your pack, but to take off your pack, get everything out, not rest, suddenly engage the mind, suddenly be like, okay, we've got to be not making any mistakes now. Do that, write it all down, check it's all waterproof and packed away properly, repack the bag, put the bag, you know, those interruptions, you can't just get into a plod. You can't just get into the zoned out phase, because you've got to be, you know, and the whole way, you know, you're anything opportune. It's not just the surveys you're taking at fixed intervals. You're also, of course, keeping your eye open for anything, you know, that could feed into your biodiversity data. So you've got to be on it the whole time, and it completely messes with you. And even someone like Iris, who's now, you know, done some very, very serious scientific objective expeditions, some really quite impressive field work. She started by cycling across Bolivia, and that had no science to it at all, but it definitely, you know, you can see that progress, that you've got to know you can handle the physical side of it, the sleep deprivation side of it, the food, the logistical side of it, before you then add in something more complicated on top of it, like a scientific or a journalistic, potentially, or you dial back on the physical side of it and really up on things. But it's they all tie in really nicely. I don't think you can object to pure adventure, because it does absolutely teach you a huge amount.
Yeah, I agree. I think probably like every podcast we have on, it's always about growth, facing adversity, and I think it always helps in day-to-day life in a sense, through tragedy or whatever experiences you have, by doing these adventures, putting yourself through hardship, I think only makes you stronger in the long term.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, I think one of the things from that is, it's not just, I think people have this image. I was actually going to go ramble off on a slight tangent, because I occasionally get approached by companies to sort of like promote their kit, and I tend not to. I don't super like it unless I've used their stuff. And you tend to get a thing where, you know, can you look quite serious in this shot, sort of thing? You know, they want you to sort of look out into the distance, looking sort of frowning. And I think a company that gets it right is something like Patagonia, where everyone's always got a massive grin on their faces, because people who do adventures and expeditions tend not to take themselves too seriously and tend to be, you know, it's a very sort of stereotype from, I don't know, James Bond's films, that you've always got to be sort of frowning and looking very serious. But what I was going to say was, before I jumped off on that slightly weird tangent, was that it's not just dealing with stuff with a frown on your face, you've got to be being positive. If you're in a team, you can't be, this is rough and I'm going to sit sullenly in a corner. You've got to be, especially for the team leader, you know, you've got to be getting everyone else happy, motivated. You've got to be very emotive. You've got to be keeping, you've got to be knowing, you know, are they being quiet because they're just humming a song in their head? Or are they being quiet because something's going wrong with their foot? Do we need to be doing some sort of early, you know, quick treatment on that? Are they developing a blister? Are they in pain? Are they feeling sick? Are they angry? Do they think we've made a mistake? You know, you've got to be in touch with that and able to communicate that and able to handle that and also able to give people space. So you've got to be really on it. That's it. But particularly in terms of the people you're meeting, because you are going into a country, it's not your country. You're potentially having some very strange encounters where you're basically just walking into someone's village in the middle of nowhere. You know, imagine, I don't know what the equivalent would be, but you know, suddenly a massive, you know, I'm 6 foot four white guy walking into a village of Sumatran people who happen to be about 5 foot four and just minding their own business in a paddy field. It's a bit bonkers. And you've got to be there, not, you know, you might be feeling shit. I might have been walking all day and all night and be very hungry and really be in a horrible mood, but you've just effectively invaded someone's back garden. You've got to be absolutely prepared to have a massive smile on your face and shake everyone's hand and be really, really friendly and hugely grateful for any help they give you and not care at all if they don't give you any help because it's completely their right not to. And yeah, for caveat, Sumatra was by far the friendliest country I've ever been to. Every single night that we were, once we left the forest and we were walking through rural areas, because we were also doing a comparative survey of different landscape types all the way through to sort of monoculture with this pristine rainforest. It was one of the sort of things we were doing. Every single night we were invited back to someone's home. You know, sometimes it was awkward because you were invited back to three or four people's homes and you had to sort of make a choice. So really sorry, but he asked first. And so it was a bit bonkers, but so absolutely incredibly friendly. And but you know, in India, you know, which is obviously a very populous country, we were meeting, met tens of thousands of people, sometimes met hundreds of people a day, that you would actually talk to, hundreds of people a day. And it can be exhausting because everyone's asking the same question, you know, where are you from? Where have you come from? What are you doing? You know, why are you doing that? And for you, it's the thousandth time you've been asked that. For them, it's the first time they've met someone. It might be the first time, you know, for kids, it will probably be in the rural areas of India, it's going to be the first time they've met someone who looks like you. And you've got to remember that. And every single interaction, you've got to be polite. You've got to be smiling. You've got to be positive. So it's not just dealing with adversity. It's dealing with adversity whilst maintaining empathy and being outwardly at least very positive, even if you're gone inside. You know. So I think it is. It's a proper lesson in that. It's a proper lesson in that.
Yeah, I agree. Sort of negativity on an expedition, especially if you're going with someone and they're complaining and negative, it brings the whole trip down.
Mm.
And so if one can just avoid that and have a big smile, I think it's quite funny how you're saying with clothing brands to sort of look serious, look left, look serious, look right. I think it's really important to always have a smile. And as you say, it's the first time you're meeting them. So it's good to give a good impression. Well, Ollie, there's a part of the show where we ask the same questions to each guest each week, with the first being, on your expeditions, what's the one gadget or that you always take with you?
I should probably give a better answer because gadget's boring. Gadget, I always take a camera. I mean, I work occasionally, semi-professionally at least, as a photographer, so I've got to have a camera on me. I take a camera over a phone, obviously I always take both. The thing that's been slightly unexpected that has ended up on every single one of my expeditions is at some point I went into TK Maxx and got an absolutely amazing deal on like a merino wool long sleeve base layer core zip thing, and it's now so scruffy, and I used it initially for running. And it's ended up, because if you go to a hot country, it's your warm layer, you know, it packs up like this. So you're wearing a light t-shirt and you put that on in the evenings and that's you done. So India and Sumatra is my warm layer. And if you go to a cold country, I was photographing in Iceland last December gone, you know, pre-COVID, I've completely lost track of when it was. You know, it's your base layer. So it's ended up on everything, cold or hot or in between, it's ended up coming. So it's things like that. I really like And I really like to try and be non-specific, think about what I can use for many different things. So I don't like to buy a piece of kit that's exclusive to a particular, you know, if you can buy something that you can also use under your dry suit kayaking, you can wear after a surf and you can wear as your belay jacket climbing, and also is super useful for an expedition because you've thought ahead and thought, okay, for an expedition it's going to take a lot of abuse, so probably, you know, I'll go for the slightly more durable one, or I'll go for the one that dries a bit quicker, or XX. Just always trying to think through maximal range of uses. I think, you know, people can get so tied down to what's the light. I'm obsessed with weight in terms of, you know, what's the lightest kit, minimal kit I can take, but I'm not necessarily obsessed on the individual thing being the best. So it's I much prefer something that does a bit of everything, that applies to a lot of different stuff, and I know I'll be able to use till it absolutely is gone. Yeah.
What about your favourite adventure or travel book?
I think anything, I don't know if you've heard the author Norman Lewis. So Norman Lewis, he died in like 2003 or something, in his late 90s, and he was a Welsh writer who, I guess he was born probably in the 20s, and he was in the Second World War, as everyone was, and he was with the Americans in Italy, and then he was all over the world, you know, Vietnam War, by which I mean the French War in Vietnam, pre the American War, and then the American War in Vietnam, and, you know, and yeah, everywhere around the world, India, all these places had, and he was at a really bloody awful time in history. I think, you know, we think, oh God, you know, now's bad. Now's bad for a lot of reasons, of course. But, you know, this is the end of colonialism, a lot of brutal wars, you know, Cold Wars peaking up on the horizon. You know, that period of history when he was very active was properly awful for a lot of people. And he was an incredibly human writer. He absolutely didn't take sides, absolutely told it how he is. He's very good at not someone who goes, and this was bad, and I thought about it this way, and it made me feel this. Just writes what happens, you know. So very good way of building trust, I think. It's very good journalistic style that he just, you absolutely see him as a witness who just tells it like it is and doesn't interpret it. And, you know, it doesn't matter that he's with the British. He will absolutely criticize the British or the Americans or, you know, etc. I mean, there's some really harrowing stuff in there. And he wrote a lot of books. Some are beautiful. Some are deeply, potentially dark. But there's a whole range. And I think one, you know, first book I read was in Sumatra. I read Empire of the East, which is him in his 80s, late 80s. He traveled around Indonesia during the Attenese Civil War. And just, you know, transformed the way you see the country. I think it's really important to read up on the history and the culture and the context of the country you go to. You know, so, you know, I was in Ethiopia a couple of years ago and knew almost nothing about any of the conflicts that had been going on over the last decades until just before I went, and you're sort of like, oh, bloody hell, all this makes sense. The sort of stuff that you go to the country, oh, that's a bit odd. And actually there is a very real and relevant meaning to it. And there's all this stuff, and it's very important not to be completely naive to that. If you can help it, obviously sometimes you can't help it. So yeah, anything by Norman Lewis is brilliant. It was the conclusion to that rant.
Why are adventures important to you?
Yeah, I guess. So right now, because they are ways of doing things, by which I mean, there is a difference for me between my early stuff, which was like adventure for the sake of adventure, and now I'm always looking for, is, you know, my day job is effectively writing about ecological environmental issues, and so it's always sort of, you know, can you use an expedition to highlight something? And I think you can incredibly effectively. And can you use it to investigate something? Can you even if you're not a scientist or you're not an archaeologist or you're not X, can you draw attention to an issue? Or can you find, you know, if you're a team leader, if you're someone who can handle all the logistical and physical side of it, can you find an archaeologist or an anthropologist or a biologist or local, you know, especially in country, who wants to come along and otherwise wouldn't have had that opportunity, especially if someone's in country. That's the really interesting thing, because then especially if you can get the budgets right, you can basically bring someone along for no extra cost if their flights aren't an issue, you know, if they're actually some option. You know, you say, well, do you want to tag along? Do you want to do some biodiversity field work? Have you got a project in mind? Can we talk to someone who would have a project in mind? And it's really easy to facilitate that. So facilitation or a key objective. So for me, it is kind of objective based is what I'm saying. But then on the other hand, for me, it is also just fun. And it's just a bug, isn't it? Like for anything, even if I do in the UK, if you're going sea kayaking, I'd much rather kayak down the coast for a week than kayak down the coast for 4 hours. And I guess that does count as an adventure. So, and that's just about getting out of the day-to-day routine and getting a bit, you know, it takes a while. I think it takes about 3 days for me, it's always what feels like my vision to really lock in and your headspace to clear. Like it takes days, not hours, I think, to really feel like you're outdoors. So I think that's why it's important to do those sort of longer journeys.
What about your favourite quote?
Ah, I've got one for you. Yeah. Life is short. Life is short. So obviously the most overused and obvious quote ever. And it is actually not, as you would imagine, something that popped up in the 90s on crappy t-shirts and Facebook. It was actually by Chaucer, and it was written about 700-800 years ago, 12th century, 13th century. And the full quote is actually quite a bit longer. It is, if I can remember off the top of my head, life is short, opportunity is fleeting, judgment is difficult. I think that's the full thing. And one, I just love that it's that old and it's maintained and it's just still applicable. And I think the whole quote is so much more interesting. Life is short, opportunity fleeting. That's it. Life is short, art is long, opportunity is fleeting, and judgment is difficult. And it's very true.
Very nice. When you said cliche, I was like, he's going to come with, it's not the destination, it's the journey. I was like, he's going to reel that one off, isn't he?
Yeah.
People listening are always keen to travel and go on these sort of grand adventures. What's the one thing you would recommend for people wanting to get started?
Something I always need to remind myself of. So especially, I mean, I could show you an Excel spreadsheet, which has got every single grant I've applied to this year. And obviously it's been a very rough year for applying to funding. And even actually, obviously partners are PhD, you know, with a lot of experience as well, and we've both hit a lot of walls on funding and all this kind of stuff, and these, you know, any sort of travel restrictions have shut a lot of stuff down. So don't, even if you're going to go big and ambitious, have a backup plan which is minimal, you can do yourself, and you can fund yourself. And by fund yourself, I mean you can do stuff very cheaply. Norway was, like I say, about 400, and I think India was under a few hundred, and there's lots more things. There's amazing stuff you could do in Europe, especially in places like Romania and Bulgaria, you know, incredibly wild places and absolutely amazing. Even Poland, you know, get there for no money. It's very cheap to be there. And yeah, so have a backup plan, or have your primary plan be something that you don't need permission to do. You don't need you don't need to wade through red tape. You don't need to wade through grant applications too. And if you want to do all of that and really go big, fine. But be prepared that if you fail, you're not going to have completely failed, because you've got plan B. And plan B, or plan C maybe, is the one that you can absolutely just do. You could walk out the door today and do it. So if you want to do a big bonkers cycle or a scientific objective or, you know, anything, or a journalistic project, whatever it might be, have a project that you can do yourself.
Finally, what are you doing now, and how can people follow your adventures in the future?
Pre-COVID, I was planning to be, last year actually, to have kayaked from mid-Alaska, down Alaska, down the west coast of Alaska, and then down Canada, sea kayaking. It's take about 4 months. And I was going to do that with my dad, because he's just retired. He'd retired that just before COVID. So that was sort of our plan, because we've always grew up sea kayaking, and obviously that was gone, but we've rescheduled that, and hopefully that'll happen in 2022, because you got to do it in the summer, so there's no chance you can do that in the winter. Alaska is a chilly place. And I'm also been putting a lot of effort into trying to get funding for a return to Sumatra. So the area I was in Sumatra is now, sadly, in the sort of 4 years since I've was there, is now the largest remaining area of intact forest outside of a reserve in Sumatra. And it still hasn't had a proper intensive survey. Like I say, we're actually only at the Curragh Massif for like 3 days, and I want to go back and do a proper intensive survey, by which I mean, you know, camera traps in the field for best part of a year, really, because that's how you find very rare species. That's how you find, you know, the stuff that's very elusive, will avoid people, you know, things like tigers, which are possibly, you know, they're in that ecoregion. So that's sort of my big ambition right now, and it would be bonkers. It would require repeat expeditions in over a period of about a year. So it's a bit bonkers, bit ambitious, really interesting. We've got an awesome Archon team apart from myself, and then Iris as a advisor, but not on the field team. So it would be really, really cool. Some Archon students as well, so absolutely fantastic, and I'd be really keen to get that working. And then sort of, you know, in terms of stuff I can do and I can fund, I've got a project actually, like I was saying, in just above Greece, and it's going to Greece, and it's a river that I'm really interested in going to. I grew up free diving, and I've always sort of wanted to go. I free dive quite a lot in rivers as well as in the sea, but obviously Cornwall's quite narrow, and we don't get very long, beautiful rivers, and we certainly don't get, you know, that we, you know, we're so bad in the UK with like pollutants and stuff like that in our water, and it's a lot of very bad visibility usually in rivers. So to go somewhere with a pristine, undammed river, intact river ecosystem, intact delta system, and just drift down effectively with a camera and over a couple of weeks and a little duffel bag with all my bivvy kit in, I'm really interested too. There's a couple of rivers I've got my eye on, because there's quite a lot of, you know, controversy around some damming projects and a few other projects going on. So there's a little bit of a journalistic angle on that. But, you know, selfishly, it's obviously something I would absolutely love to do from an experiential point of view. So yeah, to go and free dive down a river. But yeah, so to follow me, I mean, I'm on Instagram, OLI, Ollie Broadhead. And yeah, my website is probably the best place. I've been being a bit lax. I think many of us have taken a bit of a step back from social media, I think, over, you know, I certainly have. I've been one of those people who sort of like deleting it intermittently, then occasionally logging back on, which I think has been probably worth doing. Anyway, so yeah, as things progress, hopefully, trying to keep it very low ambitious, hopefully going off to kayak around the Isle of Skye fairly soon, once things open up and everything becomes safe to do, self-supported, obviously. So not hopefully not putting anyone else at risk. But you know, as lockdown permits, and no time frame on that, but sort of as soon as possible, because I'm getting sort of itchy feet to to get out. I'm sure we all are. Yeah, we all are.
Yeah, I think we all are. And yeah, with the Instagram, you always need a quick digital detox here and there. Get out into nature. But Ollie, thank you so much for coming on today. It's been absolutely fascinating hearing your stories, of which you have way more than I was ever expecting.
Good at rambling.
And yeah, do go check out his website. You're a very, very talented photographer.
Thank you.
Beautiful pictures. I'll be following your little sea kayak in the sky when everything opens.
Yeah, that's brilliant. All right, cheers.
Thank you for listening. You can watch the podcast on YouTube now, and don't forget to sign up for our adventure newsletter, which is in the description below. I hope you enjoyed the show, and if you did, tag me on Instagram at John Horsfall. I'm always keen to connect with everyone. I hope to see you next week for another fascinating tale of adventure. But till then, have a great day and happy adventures.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts, so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.